I got an article yesterday that there's one coal factory, coal electric generation station on the Great Lakes that kills 60 billion fish a year. And there's no population of anything but bacteria can survive 60 billion casualties a year. The fish in the oceans were so thick that they would slow down ships. Whales were an impediment to shipping. Sea turtles were so thick that people thought it looked like you could walk across the ocean on them. It's extraordinary, the fecundity.
This is Peak Moment. We are living at a peak of human innovation, information, wealth, and health. But we're also at a peak of population and consumption, with rising temperatures and declining resources fueled by cheap oil and gas. Peak Moment Television, bringing you examples of positive responses to energy decline and climate change through local community action.
Hi, welcome to Peak Moment. I'm Janaea Donaldson. I'm in the northwest of California in the Redwoods with Derek Jensen, the author and activist of 15 or 16 books, Language Older Than Words, Endgame, What We Leave Behind, and more recently, Deep Green Resistance. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I really wanted to tape here in your Talua country that you speak of. There's a huge stump, a redwood stump here, throughout these woods, and also second growth. And it feels to me that's sort of a fitting image for what has been and what is. And taking a look at your critique of how humans are relating to the environment. Tell us about that.
Well, first, I would say that it's not my Talua land.
You're right. I apologize.
It's Talua land. The Talua lived here for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths. The Talua Indians lived here for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. And if you believe the myths of the Talua, then they lived here since the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. In either case, they lived here for a really long time. And the dominant culture has been here for 180 years, and the place is pretty trashed. This looks beautiful here, but if you turn the camera around, you could see traffic passing on 101.
Yep.
And the salmon runs used to be so thick that horses were afraid to get in the water. They used to be so thick that people afraid to put their boats in the water for they would capsize. You could hear them for miles before you see them. And now, this is a better year for Chinook and the Smith than has been the last few years, but that doesn't alter the fact that the runs are tiny compared to what they used to be. Decimate means to kill 9 out of 10. And they've been decimated many times over. And so a question I think that would be good to ask is, how is it that the Talua could live here for 12,500 years at least, and the dominant culture destroys wherever it goes? And it wasn't because the Talua were too stupid to invent backhoes. There are huge and fundamental differences in the ways indigenous peoples have related to the land. And one of the fundamental differences, sometimes people say, Indians affected the landscape too, and the fact that they affected the landscape somehow makes it okay for Boise Cascade to clear cut. But there's a big difference, many big differences, and one of the big differences is that they were planning on living in place for the next 500 years. And if you're planning on living someplace for the next 500 years, your land use decisions are going to be really different if you're not.
It seems like our land use decisions, if you will, or civilization itself, is just moving out, destroying what it can, or taking what it can take, using it. Talk to us about the civilization we're in.
Well, there's... they say that one of the signs of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. and I'm going to lay out a pattern. Let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years. When you think of Iraq, is the first thing that you think of cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. Mm-hmm. One of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq to make cities. The Near East was heavily forested. Saudi Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, was a oak savanna.
Wow.
The Near East was heavily forested. We've all heard of the cedars of Lebanon.
Yes, yeah.
Greece was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. Mm-hmm. If you want to know about the harmful effects of agriculture and of civilization, all we have to say is that the Sahara was once the breadbasket of Rome. Italy was heavily forced. I mean, a line I think I wrote many years ago is that forests precede us and deserts dog our heels. There used to be whales in the Mediterranean. We can look at this a bunch of different directions. One of them is that so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners view perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor, as opposed to the way the world really works. I will say often at talks or in books, you know, that I was walking down a path and a tree told me what I should write. If I get stuck, I'll take a walk, and a tree will speak to me. And this is really crucial, this notion that perceiving the world as consisting of other beings to enter into relationship with, as opposed to perceiving the world as resources to be exploited. This is really crucial because how you perceive the world affects how you behave in the world.
Yes. Yes.
And if there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman, when I look at trees, I see dollar bills.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. If you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. Same is true all the way down the line.
But you're saying something very different here. Another level even is if you're taking a walk and you're speaking or you're talking to or listening to that tree, there's a relationship there. It is not just even an object, even if it's not for sale, even if you don't see, you know, even if it's not the capitalistic view. That says to me that you've got some kind of, you experience a connection in the natural world that most of us in civilization probably don't have, or very few people do.
Well, part of the reason is because it's systematically inculcated out of us.
Mm.
My book, A Language Older Than Words, was in part supposed to be a happy face when I was first trying to figure out how to write it back 95, 96. It was supposed to be this sort of happy face book about interspecies communication.
And
a compilation of all these experiences that people would have of listening to, of having a conversation with dogs or cats or coyotes or whomever. Because a lot of people I found were having these conversations in their own lives, but they weren't discussing them publicly for fear they would be shamed. And I tried to write that book for a couple of years and I couldn't do it. And I finally figured out why. And the reason is because that to try to write yet another book that purports to show that non-humans really can think and can communicate would be demeaning.
Mm.
And the reason it would be demeaning is because it'd be like trying to write a book showing that blondes really can think or that Jews really aren't subhuman, in that it would still hold up human beings as the standard by which everyone else is judged. But basically, there's a great line by this Portuguese explorer. He was talking about Africans and why it was okay to enslave them is because when they speak, they fart with their tongues in their mouths. So because they didn't speak Portuguese, they didn't speak, and which made it okay to enslave them. And so I didn't want to write a book that would, the book I was more interested in writing was not can non-humans speak or can they not, but instead, why is it that some of us listen and some of us don't? Why is it that some of us are not able to, to hear? And the problem runs all through the society on every level. whether it is the belief that that only humans can have discourse. The reason I'm hesitating is because I'm just thinking of something that I read a couple days ago that rats laugh when they play or when they're tickled. Little rats do. And A, this shouldn't really surprise us, and B, the person who did the experiment that found that out is a scientist who also vivisects rats. So even with that understanding, that doesn't alter his professional behavior. And so I was thinking about that, and I was also thinking about, there's a line by Richard Dawkins where he says, the scientific philosopher, where he says that science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command. Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command, so that when you turn on a light, something happens. And it's an extraordinary statement, because what this means is that our very epistemology is how we know what we know, and how we know what is. Our very epistemology is based on domination. It's based on forcing others to jump through hoops on command. And it's absurd, because I could pull out a gun and I could say, now you're going to do what I wish. And what do you know? I've got a gun, so you do what I wish.
Right. That's right.
What does that say about truth? And what does that say about relationship? Mm-hmm. And so I have actually, there's a way of knowing if something is true that I like better, which is, if you can live in place with something for 12,500 years, I think that is a better definition of what is true. So there's one level. In A Language All the Words, I really explored that question of why is the dominant culture destroying everything, from the perspective of, I think that this culture is so traumatizing that one of the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, especially long-term PTSD, is that you can lose the ability to... Judith Herman wrote a book, Trauma and Recovery, and in there she discussed not just regular PTSD, which is where, for example, if a woman is raped in a certain make and model of car, if she sees that make and model of car, it could give her flashbacks, could scare her. But Judith Herman asked another question, which is, what happens if someone is raised in captivity, or if someone is held in captivity? What happens to political prisoners or regular prisoners who are held for decades? Mm. What happens in domestic violence situations where you can be held as essentially a prisoner for decades? And what she found is that there are some predictable effects. And one of the predictable effects is, one can come to believe that all relationships are hierarchical.
Sure.
And one can come to believe that fully mutual relationships aren't possible. Yes. Because if all relationships that you have, if you're a prisoner and the only relationships you have are with a guard who can, with impunity, reward or punish you, you can come to believe is too weak. You can come to know, you can come to experience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You can come to forget that there are other relationships possible.
It may be that that becomes so dominant. It is your experience.
It is your experience.
Anything is diminished otherwise.
Exactly. And so I got an email from somebody the other day who said something about how if humans go extinct, wouldn't some other creature just come to dominate all the planet? And who else would be at the apex of evolution? And it's very interesting, because of course evolution doesn't really have an apex. And but there's this notion that there's this, it's like I have a friend, Dakota friend, Waz, who sometimes gets hassled a little bit by vegetarians, and her response is always, we don't project that Christian hierarchy onto the natural world of animals over plants. There is no hierarchy.
And they are the relations.
There are all these relations.
Right.
And there's no, I don't like top of the food chain, because there is no top of the food chain. I mean, if you think about it for a second, there's none, because yes, I eat a chicken or I eat a broccoli, but then I die and worms and bacteria eat me.
Okay.
And then the soil eats me. And then after the soil eats me, then the huckleberries eat me, and then a bird eats a huckleberry, and then, you know, some human eats the bird. I mean, it's a circle. And everybody knows this. Everybody who thinks about it knows it. But one of the problems is, how do we behave in our day-to-day behavior? And one of the things I say in a book I'm working on right now is that if you asked 10,000 scientists, was the world created for human beings, most of them would probably laugh at you and say, of course not.
Right.
You know, all the non-Christian ones would say, of course it was not created for human beings. It's,
right.
But if you judge their answer not by what they say, but by what they do, as soon as they're done with the interview and they go back to work, well, they're working as though, for the most part, the world was made for humans, because they're making matter and energy jump through hoops on command. So anyway, that was one book, A Language Rolled in Words, was about how we've been so traumatized by this culture that many of us are no longer even able to conceptualize the possibility of non-hierarchical relationships, and non-hierarchical relationships, fully mutual relationships with non-human beings especially.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or even with human beings. I mean, between men
right,
and women, for crying
right.
out loud.
Yeah.
The next book, Culture Make-Believe, we're not going to go through all the books here. The next book, Culture Make-Believe, was really about how the culture is unsustainable on a sociological level, by which I mean that the book is really, it started off to be an exploration of hate groups, and it was going to be a 5-page introduction to an encyclopedia of hate groups, and I realized the book exploded when I asked the question, what's a hate group? Because the first thing I did is I went to a KKK website, and the KKK said, we're not a hate group, we're a love group because we love whites. So either A, you can't trust rhetoric,
yeah,
or B, the KKK is not a hate group. Well, I'll go with that, can't trust rhetoric. But if you can't trust rhetoric, what do you trust? Well, if you go just by the numbers, and the biggest segregationist racist organization in the country is the U.S. Judicial and Penal System, because it achieves segregation of African-American males on a scale the KKK can only dream of. About 30% of African males are under criminal justice supervision
Whoa.
In the country between the ages of 18 and 35.
Yeah, yeah.
Some cities like Baltimore, it's over 50%. And, I mean, that's the KKK wet dream. And so I started then asking, you know, what does hate feel like? And what I eventually came to is that any hatred felt long enough no longer feels like hatred. It feels like religion or economics or the way things are.
I get that it's the way things are. Again, it's what you experience. And if you're permeated with that, if that's what you're swimming in, there isn't another reality then.
Yeah, so the Nazis weren't, you know, the individual Nazis working at death camps weren't, you know, they weren't sort of red-faced and shouting. What we think of when we think of hate, you know,
mm-hmm,
we think
mm-hmm.
of
anger and
anger.
Yeah, yeah, and violence.
They weren't necessarily, in fact, they were, the whole thing was very bureaucratic. And when we think of, it's very interesting because, you know, pornography is very destructive, and it's very, I was talking to Gail Dines about this, who's an anti-porn activist, and she was saying that when pornographers get together at their conventions, they talk about money. And it's not, I don't think that most loggers hate for us. I think they're doing it for a paycheck.
Yeah.
So, but the manifestation, I talk about how we're enculturated. This culture teaches us to hate the natural world. And one of the ways it does that is this hatred is felt so deeply that in that book, one of the things I come to is that, a couple of things. One of them is that I don't have a problem with hate. I think hate's a fine and righteous emotion. I can hate someone because of what he or she has done okay. to me or to someone else. But what I have a bigger problem with is persistent objectification. So mm-hmm. I can hate mm-hmm. a particular African-American lesbian because of what she has done to me. Just a theoretical, hypothetical example. On the other hand, if I hate her because she's an African-American lesbian, I'm not even doing her the honor of hating her personally.
Oh. okay. All right.
Instead, I'm hating a cardboard cutout that I'm projecting onto the space where she would be if I actually perceived her. And of course, we all objectify all the time. You can't go around recognizing that everybody has hobbies and somebody's foot hurts and somebody else, you know.
Yeah, all the distinctions. Yeah.
You can't, you know, there have been people walk by outside and we can't, we would just, we would existentially explode if we recognized. But the problem is that if you do nothing but objectify, which is what the economic system systematically mm-hmm. caused us to do. There's a great article in the paper last year, I think it was, when the crab season was just finishing. They were saying one of the reasons the crabbers work so hard is because every crab's worth $1.50. And the harbor master said, can you imagine if there were all these envelopes on the ground and each envelope's worth $1.50? Of course, you're going to run around picking them up as fast as you can.
Sure, sure.
But the thing is, a crab is not an envelope full of $1.50. A crab is a living being with a life just as precious to that crab as yours is to you and mine is to me. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that we can never kill a crab or a crab apple or a broccoli.
Because eating and being eaten is the natural way things are.
That's the price you pay for living, is that you're going to be eaten someday.
Yeah.
And it's all about reciprocity. There's a great line I just heard recently. It's by Charlotte Perkins Gilmore. Charlotte Gilmore Perkins. I'm blanking on it right now. She's a great writer. Anyway, one of the things she said was the Buddha went out and saw that everyone is killing and eating each other, and that's evil. She said, I went out and I changed one word. I went out and I saw them, and I saw that everyone is feeding each other, and it's all good. And this gets right to it again. So anyway, cultural make-believe was basically about how if you have a culture that's based on that's based on competition and based on perceiving others as lesser, then you're going to lead inevitably to atrocity. And then one last thing, which is Endgame was based on the notion that if you have a way of life that's based on the importation of resources, that also can never be sustainable, because it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And as your city grows, you'll denude ever larger areas. That one of the reasons the Talawa could live here for 12,500 years is because they didn't take more than what the land gave willingly. And if you take more than what the land gives willingly, you're going to harm your land base. And we're all taught, see, this is how deep the problems go, that we're all taught that evolution is based on competition, is based on survival of the fittest.
Sure, sure.
And that's just capitalism projected onto the natural world. And it's so stupid, I can show that that's not true in one sentence with a couple of semicolons. And that is, the creatures who've survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. Okay. You survive in the long run by actually improving your habitat.
Improving your habitat.
That's what salmon do. They make the world a better place. They make the forest a better place because they were born and because they die. Because they lived and died.
It seems then that that's the maxim that we ought to be living by, and we're doing this civilization is doing just the opposite of that.
Is the world a better place because you were born? That's the question. And we can say how do we think that the world got to be so beautiful and fecund and resilient in the first place? It's by individuals living and dying, and by communities efflorescing. It's by salmon hatching and going downstream and then bringing nutrients back up and eating out in the ocean and bringing nutrients back up and dying and then being eaten by the trees. That's how the forest became so spectacular in the first place. And it's pretty straightforward, and everybody has to know this. And if they don't, they don't survive. And this culture has is doing. I mean, it's in The Selfish Gene. Richard Dawkins talks about how you could have natural selection based on cooperation, or you could have it based on competition. But the problem is with the cooperation, he says, is if you have a cheater, everything falls apart. And it's like, Richard, look around. There's a cheater and everything's falling apart. And so pretty clearly, anyway, so the point is that the central point is you cannot take what the land give, what more than what the land gives willingly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's back to where we were, the desertification from the beginning of
which
agriculture.
Is what the, see, one of the disadvantages or one of the problems is that taking more than the land gives you willingly gives you a competitive, short-term competitive advantage
yes,
over your neighbors.
That's right.
So, for example, the forests of North Africa went down to make the Phoenician and Egyptian navies. If they were going to cut down forests and turn them into warships, they had a competitive advantage over their neighbors who didn't do that. And that's, there's a great line by this guy, Samuel Huntington, who basically says, people in the West think that the world has been won, to use his word, by the power of Western ideas. Instead, it's been won by the ability of the West to apply organized violence. Westerners always forget this. The colonized never do. Mm-hmm. And that's really mm-hmm. true. I mean, the reason that the dominant culture has been able to succeed is because it's been tremendously successful at applying organized violence, including to the natural world, of course. I mean, what do you call pesticides?
And to all their neighbors. Which we're seeing wholesale. I mean, we're seeing wholesale results of that.
Yeah, there is no stream in the United States that is not contaminated with carcinogens. And a study just came out a couple days ago that basically, I don't know, 35 out of 37 cities they studied or something like that have just pretty huge levels of carcinogens in the drinking water. I mean, who's the idiot who came up with the idea? You know, Pittsburgh just recently has passed a resolution outlawing fracking within the city limits, fracking using a bunch of nasty chemicals, which pollute the groundwater. I mean, who could be so absurd as to, and murderous, as to poison your groundwater, poison the groundwater?
Well, if it's not your drinking water, and it's somebody else, there's that objectification again.
Right.
It's somebody else's, so what? Let's exploit it and take what we want. What I want to do is I want to take a pause. I want to thank you, and then let's continue.
Okay, that sounds great.
I'm with Derek Jensen. This is part one of conversations about civilization, the natural world. Join us next time.